You're listening to the Faces of Armenia podcast.
Hello, friends of Faces of Armenia. Today we have the great pleasure of meeting Simon Sarajian to share his perspective on the worsening crisis of the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict. But before we get into the nitty-gritty details, Simon, could you give a little bit about your background?
I come from a village in what used to be the Shoman district, and prior to that was the Gulistan Principality, part of the Gulistan Principality of Artsakh, known as Nagorno-Karabakh these days. And my father and mother are Armenian, and I spent my initial years of life there in my village and in Armenia. And then my father, who was an officer, took us to his new tour of duty, which was outside Moscow. And that's where I grew up. And I went to university in Moscow. And then upon graduating, I worked as a journalist and then as a part-time researcher for 15 years, based in Moscow, covering defense, security, foreign policy issues in the post-Soviet neighborhood. In between this work, I went to America and got a master's degree at Harvard University. Then I went back, worked some more, and then I came back here when there was an opening in a center headed by my professor, Graham Allison. And since 2018, I've been based at Harvard, where I research post-Soviet neighborhood, again, the same issues, and where I've launched a project called Russia Matters, which looks at the developments in the same region through the prism of US vital interests. So that's what I do these days. That's my background.
And could you maybe elaborate a little bit on the project that you're currently working on?
So as I said, Russia Matters is a project that focuses on the post-Soviet neighborhood, primarily on Russia. And it looks at developments in that neighborhood that impact US vital interests. The project was launched in 2016 with support from Carnegie Corporation, and it's based at the Belfer Center of the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. And it features in-depth analysis of the region, lots of comparative data, fact checks, news digests, blog posts. Essentially, it's a go-to website if you want to educate yourself on Russia, on those trends in Russia and post-Soviet neighborhood that impact US vital interests.
So we will certainly check this out, this resource. And Simon, if you could also give a little bit perspectives leading up to the Nagorno-Karabakh crisis. As a professional, did you foresee the events or did they come all of a sudden? And according to your understanding, what is the current situation right now?
Well, I think there's hardly anyone who follows the region who would have been surprised by the flaring up of hostilities. I mean, they have happened before, and this is just one of them, but it is unprecedented in scale. We haven't seen anything like that since, the ceasefire was signed in 1994.
Yeah.
And even the events a few years ago do not compare. I think the reason for this particular flaring up that threatens to become an all-out war is Azerbaijani's disappointment in or realization that their hope that they could impose a negotiated solution on the new leadership of Armenia on terms that are mostly favorable to Azerbaijan. They realize that this is not going to happen. And the leadership of Azerbaijan, Ilham Aliyev primarily, has by then become a hostage of his own effort to divert the public's attention from the domestic ills of the Azerbaijani society, such as social inequality, corruption, and so forth, through agitating the public towards and rallying it towards what he sees and portrays as an external enemy, Armenia. So if you spend years and years saying Armenia is an enemy, they the occupier, and do nothing about it, eventually, you know, your constituency becomes so hostile and warlike that you are obliged to act. Otherwise, they will tell you that you're not up to your job. So I think this combination of the disappointment in whatever futile hopes they had that Pashinyan would yield in negotiations, and the escalation of the anti-Armenian feelings fueled by Ilham Aliyev's own tactics of diversifying attention, diverting attention from the, flows of his rule, led to what we see today. And it threatens to become a full-out war, which is very dangerous and which can drag more external powers into the conflict. I think Turkey is already involved. So, not a good time, basically, for the region and for Armenia.
And so would you actually say this is a great example of the natural resource curse that Azerbaijan hit, because Azerbaijan was not able to diversify its economy as a result and only sees its legitimacy as in lobbying against and threatening Armenia?
Well, I do and I don't. In political science, there's very rarely such thing as monocausality. So, and the theory of explaining everything through petrostate predicament is just one theory. I think it's a combination of factors. I think what you said played a role. But also, as I said, the external factors, or rather the disappointment of the Azerbaijani leadership in Pashinyan's lack of preparedness to negotiate on their terms has played a role in what has happened too. Turkey's willingness to render direct support, which reportedly does, and it has F-16s apparently operating out of the Ganja, what I mean is Ganzak airport. They have also played a role. I mean, they feel emboldened by this direct support, and they also feel emboldened by Russia's offhand attitude. Vladimir Putin hasn't spoken to Ilham Aliyev even once since the beginning of the campaign. So there's no, I don't see any pressure from Russia other than diplomatic rhetoric. And the same goes, by the way, for France and US and other external powers. I don't see any pressure on Azerbaijan, real pressure, to discontinue the hostilities.
So that would have brought me right to my second question, since you are a Russia expert. Russia was always seen as a great mediator between Armenia and Azerbaijan, albeit not very effective always. But how do you see could the role of Russia play out in this conflict?
So Russia has viewed the region as a zone, a part of its zone of so-called privileged interests. And that prism makes Russia try to retain influence, not only just on Armenia, which is participating in every Russian-led integration project you could think of, but also to retain influence in Azerbaijan, which Russia sees as an important player, given the size of its economy, given its energy resources, and on Georgia. And that dictates Russia's reluctance to take sides in the conflict. But this stance obviously conflicts with the commitments that Russia has assumed when it has entered an alliance with Armenia and other countries, which is known as the Collective Security Treaty Organization. So I'd say so far, Russia remains retains that neutrality stance, but I think the more this war develops, the harder it would be for Russia to remain neutral and not to get involved. That said, if you look at the past record, Russia did try in earnest as part of the Minsk group, OSCE Minsk group, to broker a solution. But just like other members of that group, it hasn't been able to do so because essentially the positions of the two sides are irreconcilable. Azerbaijan does not want to give up its claim to Nagorno-Karabakh, and Armenia doesn't accept Azerbaijan, Karabakh in Azerbaijan. So no matter how earnest and creative the Minsk group could have been, and it could have been more creative and more energetic, I don't think they could have resolved this irreconcilable situation.
And then recently, I think there came an article out mentioning that as a response to Turkish air fighter jet shooting down an Armenian fighter jet, Yerevan is discussing to activate the CSTO 10th treaty. Do you think that like other external forces, rather Russia, Tajikistan, etc., will be unwillingly dragged into a war by this activation?
I don't think they could be unwillingly dragged into war. I mean, countries like Belarus has actually, which is a member of the Collective Security Treaty Organization, has been more accommodating towards Baku than Yerevan, if only because of the underlying economic interests. So this could become another moment of reckoning for the Collective Security Treaty Organization. If it fails, if Armenia invokes clauses in the treaty and the organization fails to act, it's going to damage its reputation. It's going to strengthen the conviction that it's a paper tiger rather than a real alliance. Mm-hmm. And it's just going to reflect badly on Russia, which is the ultimate leader of that alliance. But as long as the conflict remains largely focused on the line of contact of Karabakh and Azerbaijan, Russia could always say this is not, and other members of CSTO could say this is not within jurisdiction of the Collective Treaties Security Organization. If the conflict, and it has already begun to expand to areas like Vardanis, expands to the border of Armenia and Azerbaijan proper, then Armenia could legally argue that this is a conflict that threatens its territorial integrity, and therefore, according to a clause of coming to each other's aid in the treaty, other members of the treaty are obliged to help it. But again, I very much doubt that these members are going to just, you know, line up behind Armenia and say, yes, we're intervening, and Azeri aggression has to stop.
And then before we shine light on the mediation, potential conflict resolution processes, can you share your perspective of the series of de-escalations that have happened over the last few days, and according to your information, where we currently are in the stage of the war crisis slash?
I don't see any de-escalation. All I see is escalation. Every day brings more offensive from the Azeri side, as we see on news, and the fighting doesn't subside. So we are not anywhere near that stage where there could be de-escalation. You could see, Azerbaijan's minimum objective is to gain land to claim a victory and also impact what negotiation theory describes as the best alternative to the negotiated agreement, Batna, of Armenia, by showing it that it's stronger, it can resolve the issue militarily. So that's the minimum. But if Azerbaijan senses that it could expand its gains further, why stop? There hasn't been, as I say, at least publicly known, as of today, a real concerted effort on the part of the international community and the Minsk group to exercise real sources of leverage vis-a-vis the two countries, primarily Azerbaijan, to stop hostilities. Until that happens, the conflict is going to escalate unless there's a stalemate. So far, the situation is fluid, and Azerbaijan believes it can gain more ground. So I don't see, in the short term, any strong possibility of de-escalation.
Then very quickly, let's shine on compare and contrast 2016. The 2016 war ended with a ceasefire agreement after only 4 days. And we are very well aware that the escalations are significantly more harsh this time around from Azerbaijan. But where do you see the fundamental differences, which may indicate that it will really not be a short-term clash?
I mean, I don't have a crystal ball to say whether it's whether it's going to be short-term clash or long-term clash. It's just what I said was, as of today, I don't see anything in the situation that tells me that this is going to de-escalate. As long as Azerbaijan keeps having hopes that it can gain territory and then claim a tactical victory, which would, you know, play up to Aliyev's popularity in the domestic audience and put pressure on Armenia, this is going to continue. If the sides fight to a stalemate, which again, I don't have a crystal ball, will they fight to a stalemate? If the international stakeholders intervene in a meaningful way, then the fighting would subside. So, I mean, that is a question that nobody knows the answer to. Is tomorrow going to be another day of escalation? Well, it certainly looks like it's going to be that. But it could be that, you know, Vladimir Putin calls Ilham Aliyev tomorrow morning and says, stop, I'll do X, Y, and Z. And, you know, Aliyev yields. Or Armenians could launch a counteroffensive that would actually expand their zone of control. And that would coerce Aliyev into seeking ceasefire. So nobody knows the answer to that.
And especially here, where we would like to hear your perspective, what maybe new mechanisms are available that can be tested, for example, in the international community for a mediation process, for a conflict resolution that will actually work? we all know that this conflict has been essentially dragging on ever since Stalin drew inappropriate borders and inflamed with Armenian independence. So is there a new mechanism or method that we should think about to institute?
Well, I mean, diplomacy, as some joke, is the second oldest profession. So anything in that field that people could have invented as mechanism has already been invented. This conflict is centuries old. I mean, I take a long view. If anything, when I was reading documents from the Armenian archive from the 1918s, I was under the impression that I was reading news out of Karabakh when I was there in 1991. It's the same sort of a ethnic violence that enveloped the region. So this is viewed essentially as an existential struggle on the Armenian side, I'd like to say. As for the mechanisms, you know, as I said, I don't see anything new that could be invented. Unless you have, as a mediator, not only have, but also have political will to yield that leverage vis-a-vis the warring sides or the conflicting sides, there's nothing you can do. So if Minsk Group tomorrow were to say EU, and France is a member of EU and OC Group, mm-hmm. US and Russia are going to impose crippling sanctions on Armenia and Azerbaijan. If they do not discontinue this conflict, we're going to impose trade blockades and, you know, we're going to arrest accounts and so on and so forth. And, you know, the leaders of the countries would be tried in international criminal court. You know, that kind of a united position could impress both sides that it's time to seek peace, yeah? But it's you and I know that this is not going to happen.
Yeah, but actually that brings up a very interesting topic. I don't know if you're aware, at the end of the George Bush presidency, there was the idea floated to have an international conference on Nagorno-Karabakh. Unfortunately, it never took place, but it was the first concerted international efforts to bring the leadership of both countries together, along with a number of other countries, including France and the United States, Russia and Germany. Would something like that be a potential avenue that could be like rekindled with?
I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, conference is just a format. I mean, you focus on form in your questions, but the answers are in actual substance. You know, if the sides were willing to negotiate a meaningful resolution, the format wouldn't be as important. In fact, I would advise against an international conference. I would suggest track 1.5, track 2 first, and then track 1 kind of approach. But the willingness to reach a negotiated solution is not very high on either side. As I said, the positions are irreconcilable because Azerbaijan wants Karabakh in Azerbaijan. Armenia says it's not going to happen. So you can have an international conference. You can have a track 2 secret meeting. You can have a small group meet with Minsk OSC group of states and foreign ministers of OEC countries. It's just not going to happen until there's will on both sides to reach a solution.
And if I may put out a question also, do you think can the citizens be part of the process? Can citizens, like especially from Armenia and Azerbaijan, start like discussion forums to get to know each other in order to create a base in each country that seeks or that pressures the political leadership to rethink their hostile relationships?
That's always part of the solution. People democracy. Mm-hmm. It's been tried. There's been some progress in building trust among the two peoples, but that was not a lasting impact. In fact, Azerbaijan never stopped very hostile propaganda that portrayed Armenians as the ultimate hellish enemies from hell. And that continued to influence. Armenian media also didn't have a favorable coverage, though they didn't use as strong terms as the Azeri media. So for popular diplomacy to flourish, the governments on both sides should be willing to tolerate it at the very least. And there's no such tolerance.
Yes.
There's been no such tolerance on the Azerbaijani side. We know that people got arrested and charged with being Armenian spies because they participated in this people-to-people diplomacy. So yes, that's a useful tool. But again, this tool has been tried before. It's not a new tool, just like an international conference isn't. So, everything that you could think of in diplomacy has been tried. But for sides to pursue a meaningful resolution, you need to have them, have so-called zone of possible agreement overlapping. They need to agree on something, and they just don't.
So you really speak out of my heart. I have many similar observations, especially also one effort of mine, which was specifically targeted to getting Armenians and Azeri meet. And on the Azeri side, I got the feedback that they are scared to engage in any such activity because at home they really need to fear repercussions.
Right. Well, that's same thing as you would expect. Mm-hmm. Azerbaijan is an authoritarian regime, and any kind of dissent of that kind it views as a threat. So yeah, it's just I have very bleak, unless the situation changes on the ground that forces either or both of the players to reconsider the alternative to the negotiated agreement, this is going to be the stalemate.
So, Simon, so far, I really do appreciate, and I'm very impressed by your wonderful insights and words. And I would like to turn to sort of the last part of the interview, which is, what are your perspectives of the implications that this border conflict will have on Armenia, its partners, and on the world at large? Specifically from the perspective the conflict is maybe a ceasefire signed sometime, but it will be the second time that war broke out. How will partners react? Will there be any hesitation 5 years, 10 years down the road? What are your predictions? What are your perspectives?
Well, I think this particular conflict is particularly dangerous, not because of only of the scale that we haven't seen in the past decades. Since the ceasefire, but because Turkey is directly getting involved in actual military combat. If these reports are true, that's a game changer. Okay, so that means the zone of privileged interests, as Russia has prescribed it, is no sacrosanct, even to middle powers like Turkey, that it could use force to change the situation on the ground, which is part of the zone of interest. It also brings us further away from the Cold War order, where there were two superpowers and they had their zones of interest and they had rules of the game. We're moving to a very fluid interregnum in international relations, when there are no games of rules of the game, because the old rules are no longer being observed and the new ones are yet to be agreed upon. And it's a very threatening environment. So if you put that conflict in that context, it becomes even more threatening. I foresee future instability in the region and the world as a whole until this new world order emerges and the new equilibrium appears that ensures that the countries follow rules of the game in their interaction with each other, rather than, you know, go rogue and act opportunistically to try to solve things through military use of military force.
So what does it mean for the people living in the region? How will their lives change?
Well, for the people of the region, it unfortunately entails great instability, and the great instability comes with security risks. The personal safety is threatened, civilians are getting killed, but also it impacts economy, and therefore it impacts their incomes. So less secure, underprivileged lives is what, for common people, I could say is going to happen increasingly more and more if these kinds of hostilities and instability continues to plague the South Caucasus.
And I can only imagine how depressive this must be to face a reality, especially from the perspective that Armenia just really emerged and pierced in the last 9 years, like after especially the Velvet Revolution, pierced towards a really fairly bright future. I think in 2018, Armenia's economy just alone had the fastest growth rate globally.
Yes, the ascent of Pashinyan to power had its own advantages for the public, and, you know, benefiting from the economic growth is one, and the rates were indeed high. But one needs to take a longer view, and the longer view would tell us that, you know, vis-a-vis its neighbors, unfortunately, the share of Armenia's economy is declining, the share of population is declining. And even without a war, if we continue on this trajectory of depopulation, this is going to lead to a situation where no one even has to fight a war with Armenia. So this is an existential challenge, and working towards, you know, great economic output is an important part of reversing this trend, but it needs to be done. It needs to be consistent. It needs to be accompanied by trickling down of the benefits of the economic growth to the broader circles of the society. And it also needs to be utilized to reverse the population. So I should say that internal challenges to Armenia are as grave as the external when you take the long view. So, you know, Pashinyan has done a good job on the economy. He can take credit for that, but this needs to go on, and this needs to be utilized to reverse the negative trends. It will be very difficult to do so if there's a war going on, okay? So not everything depends on the political will of the country. It also depends on the broader geopolitical situation. But at least there's hope. At least there's still opportunity to do so, and I hope it will be done.
And then if you could talk to the Armenian leadership, to the Armenian crisis leadership, and if you would give them like some luggage on their way, some tips. What would be your specific policy implementation recommendations, key of focus, other than reversing depopulation trends? Also from a partnership perspective, what can the Armenian leadership to do to both handle the crisis and to navigate the country into a future that is not worse than today?
I mean, I cannot give advice or any counsel to Armenian leadership on how to wage, how to defend the nation from the current hostilities. That's the job of general staff and strategists in the defense ministry. So if this conflict were resolved on terms acceptable for Armenia, this particular round of conflict, I would say that focus not just on reversing on economic growth, but focus on diversification of economy. Focus on sectors that have less transportation costs and more added value, high tech. I would suggest investing more and more into not just quantity of human capital, but also quality. Again, giving population the skills that allows them to work and benefit in spite of the hostile external environment, in spite of this semi-blockade. So working on essentials that constitute the national power, okay, and no matter what formula of calculating that you take, it's the economy, it's the population, it's the skills of population in some of the more advanced formulas, and it's the military strength. All these components need to be strengthened and expanded and fostered to ensure that Armenia can defend itself against its peer. I mean, it cannot defend itself against Turkey. Mm-hmm. That requires assistance from allies. And it can become competitive. I mean, if you Google my last name and Singapore, you'd come across an article I've written where I compare Singapore with Armenia, because they have started, you know, from long starting point. They're both small nations. Mm-hmm. And they have other comparable things. But the paths are divergent. And what is it that countries like Singapore, small nations, do to succeed and become enormously wealthy, competitive, and vibrant? So you don't have to discover anything. Everything is in there. Everything has been done before. And as long as the recipe is there, but there's no political will to implement, this is just not going to happen. So you need political will to consistently pursue implementation of what I've just described.
So, as a concluding remark from me, I'm sorry, but there is a strategic difference between Armenia and Singapore. Singapore has access to ports, to water, goods can come in and flow, and that was to the great what contributed to the rise of Singapore. While Armenia, a lot of entrepreneurs, people from various sectors that I talk to, lament that it is not always that easy to get the products, the input materials in that you need in order to build certain industries. So I was thinking Singapore grew up in the age of value chains. Maybe can Armenia develop the future of digital value chains, of value chains that are not reliant anymore on heavy infrastructure?
So no analogy is perfect. No country is like second Armenia. Singapore definitely is not. But I'm saying, if you look at Ernst's main methods of whether you can draw analogy, you gotta look what were the things that are similar and what the things were startlingly different. And I'd say there were more similar things when Singapore started. And one of the things that doesn't require access to sea, but in which Singapore has excelled is enormous leaps in improvement of human capital. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at their public sector, they're unmatched in terms of the quality of public administration. I mean, thank Lee Kuan Yew for that and his team.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the private sector, also lots of skilled workers, not only from Singapore, but also attracted from other countries. So if you could make Armenia attractive and well-governed, that'll take you a long way towards achieving the goals I've just described, okay? The other example, when it comes to selling high value added services and goods that do not have huge transportation costs is Israel. Look, Israel is in a, also a semi-hostile environment,
mm-hmm.
but it has managed to develop into a very successful state. And if you look at its relationship with China, the stuff that Israel sells to China is really high value-added stuff like pharmaceuticals and high-tech equipment and so on and so forth. So what I'm driving here is less, okay, well, Singapore is not the perfect example. Israel is not the perfect example. But the thing is, there's no perfect example. You cannot draw a perfect analogy. What I said was the recipes for success are known, okay? You need to pursue them. You need political will to pursue them and to focus on them to achieve a qualitative change. Is it going to happen? Is this conflict a wake-up call? I don't know. Or are the authorities are going to divert their attention on things like prosecuting political rivals for real or imagined crimes? I don't know. I don't have the answer to that. But I hope they stay focused on things that really, really matter to the survival and sustainable development of the Armenian nation. And that takes a lot of effort, a lot of political will to develop the pillars of national power I've described to you.
Simon, so what can I say? We thank you very much for your time, for your insights and timely expertise on the very pressing topic of Armenia. And I think many of our listeners, so to speak, will find your words useful. And I hope that also a number of individuals in positions of power who can proact change will hear your words and maybe come in contact to you. So
let me interrupt there and install a important disclaimer. I mean, I don't pretend to know the answers to the hard questions that Armenia is facing. And, the easiest thing people do is like give advice, sitting somewhere in a chair, like thousands of miles away, you advise. It is, I'd like to stress that it's up to the Armenians living in Armenia, actually all ethnic groups that living in Armenia, Yazidis, Russians, it is up to them to decide what they want to do and how they want to do it, okay? All those who are sympathetic to the Armenian nation, to Armenia as the country, can only support, okay, and provide support. But it's up to them to decide what they want and how they want to achieve it.
I fully agree with you. No one knows the answer, and I think that is not the point. The point is that the community, a global community, becomes interested and talks about Armenia, which will propel confidence and action in Armenia, and which will make them which will push them to act, to think, what do they want? What do they want for themselves? What do they think is the best answer of all the support that is offered?
Right. Okay. Thanks.
So, yeah, as I said, I can't thank you enough. It was wonderful speaking with you. And let me know if you have any concluding remarks or if you want to greet anyone.
No, I'm fine.